Greetings, ladies and gentlemen. This is Shank Talk Worldwide. I'm your host, Peter Shank, and my guest today is Mr. Bob Whitaker. Bob Whitaker is a self-described overeducated redneck from Pontiac, South Carolina, whose father was an expert in the brick industry. At the age of 16, he entered the University of South Carolina, where he graduated with a degree in political science. He did his postgraduate studies in economics at the University of Virginia before embarking on a career spent mainly in practical politics. A Washington insider, he was a senior staffer on Capitol Hill and a Reagan appointee. He was also a university professor and knows all too well the undesirable machinations of academia. Bob is now enjoying retirement in the capital of South Carolina. Bob, welcome to the program.
Thanks, sir. I appreciate it.
Bob, before we start the program, before we get into this, you have an interesting mantra. I'd like you to share it with the listeners.
All right. It's about genocide against white people. They're short. Heads off. Africa for the Africans. Asia for the Asians. Black countries for everybody. And it says, respect liberals and respectable conservatives agree that there is this race problem. They say this race problem will be solved when the third world pours into every white country and only into white countries. The Netherlands and Belgium are as crowded as Japan or Taiwan, but nobody says Japan or Taiwan will solve some race problem by bringing millions of third worlders and, quote, assimilating, unquote, with them. Everybody says the final solution to this race problem is for every white country and only white countries to assimilate, i.e. intermarry with all these non-whites. What if I said that there was this race problem, and this race problem would be solved only if hundreds of millions of non-blacks were brought into every black country and only into black countries? How long would it take for anyone to realize I'm not talking about a race problem? I'm talking about the final solution to the black problem. And how long would it take any sane black man to notice this, and what kind of psycho black man wouldn't object to it? But if I tell that obvious truth about the ongoing program of genocide against my race, the white race, liberals and respectable conservatives agree that I am a Nazi who wants to kill 6 million Jews. Well, they say they are anti-racist. What they are is anti-white. Anti-racist is a code word for anti-white.
Well, Bob, you know what? You've brought up some great points. You were in Washington. You used to work in the Reagan administration. What was going on at that time? Did people recognize this problem back in the Reagan years?
Most of the conservatives were all for it, for immigration because of cheap labor. They would say free markets and the free movement of goods, services, and labor. They didn't make any distinction. And of course, labor votes. I mean, if you bring in what this commodity called labor, you are changing your country. And the reason that a Mexican can move to America and make more money is because America is populated by Americans. I did put that in my second book, The New Right Papers, called Societal Property Rights. Americans have the right to this productive society they created. And if you fill it up with Mexicans or anybody else, it's going to turn in to Mexico.
Well, this
it's a rather obvious point, but nobody seems to notice. I mean, nobody noticed it until I brought it up.
Well, what is the name of your second book once again?
Oh, The New Right Paper. It was St. Martin's Press.
So when you were back on Capitol Hill and you were working for the Reagan administration, did you ever bring up these points around your colleagues, people you worked with?
Yeah, but nobody, they would go on and talk about something else. People I'm interested in, see, I'm talking about the worldwide picture, that this is genocide against the white race. And most people want to talk about details. It's sort of like the old joke, you know, when the reporter said, but otherwise, Mrs. Lincoln, how was the play?
Yeah, well, Mr. Whitaker, how was the play? I mean, when you were up there working in the Capitol, so you're telling us, some people believe that there are people that are like-minded, like, you know, like yourself or like Peter Schenck,
mm-hmm.
and that are actually working in the Capitol, but they don't reveal their true ideology for fear of losing their job. But obviously what your experience has been is quite the opposite. Really, no one is that you've run across is very interested in this problem. Anybody with common sense could see it happening all around them.
Well, it's not so much common sense as it is they don't give a damn. I mean, politics, and remember, it's like Winston Churchill said, politics is a system of government where you get what you deserve. And the people elect congressmen because they talk right and all that stuff, not because they address long-term problems like this.
I see. Now, you've coined this phrase, wordism. At least mm-hmm. I think you have. I've never heard of this phrase before. What is wordism?
Well, since I started talking about it years back, other people, I generally put in out my ideas to be stolen because, you know, by now I'm so unrespectable. I'm unrespectable, but these people need ideas. And now they call it the propositional state. Have you heard that term?
I don't really think I have, no.
Well, it's George Will said, Frenchmen are Frenchmen, Germans are Germans, America is a propositional state. If you agree with the proposition, then you're an American.
I see. Oh, yes, I have heard this phrase, yes.
Yeah. Well, the wordism is, of course, that's what I call it, because it's the alternative to racism. In other words, Marxism is a form of wordism. It says you're a good Soviet citizen if you agree with the words. During the Inquisition, for example, it didn't matter what race you were. What mattered was whether you were had the right religion or not, the right words.
I see. And so wordism, according to your bio here, wordism, you've said, is a nation can be founded upon either a people, racial, ethnic group, or upon a concept based in essence upon kinship or words. The problem with basing a country on a concept is that words are up to a matter of interpretation, as a propositional nation is bound to continually change because its meaning is based solely on people's opinions. Yes, I would wholeheartedly agree with that.
Well, that's why we have these hate speech laws today, because the problem with basing your state on a proposition is that you can't allow anybody to disagree with your proposition. That's treason.
And that's
if you have a country.
I'm saying that's what we see today with the hate speech laws in the various Western countries, Canada in particular. You see people being prosecuted simply for having a different opinion of a historical event such as the Holocaust.
Right. And in Europe, you can go to jail for 2 years for actually what amounts to disputing diversity. If you say anything that offends any group, you can go to prison for it.
Now, you refer to the World War II generation as the weakest generation. Would you please elaborate?
Well, they were the ones. When I was coming up, I was fighting, you know, for my race and for various things. And the World War II generation would keep saying, well, I'm not going to get in on that fight because I already did my job. And they usually use sort of a macho approach to backing down. But as I say, in the 1930s, before that generation took over, the white race ruled the world. And it was during that generation and the one they raised that everything was given away. And I think it has to do with the fact that it took a whole generation of young men, and basic training then was brutal. They just beat them into obedience. What I call obedience training. They called themselves dog faces, and I think that was a pretty good word for it, for what I saw.
Well, you also mentioned that they adopted the can't fight City Hall mindset, and said that capitulation to progressivist demands was necessary because the authorities were to be respected and can't be effectively fought.
Right. Well, all the American rebelliousness was beaten out of them. That's what happened to 12 million. One in 11 of American citizens who were in the armed forces went through the training and then learned as their first youthful lesson that it didn't really matter what you wanted. The state was what was important.
Well, in addition, you see the idea of the melting pot, and that this was a very popular idea that was put forth during World War II, the idea that we're a nation of immigrants fighting against the Nazis, who were white supremacists or whatever they thought about them back then. Very, very interesting time because, first, this is one of the most censored periods of time. The popular culture has made laws, voted in laws, to censor a serious investigation of World War II and the Holocaust. This period of time probably is a turning point in the history of mankind. I would say.
I know I bounce around a lot, but I've done an awful lot of thinking and writing about these things, and really, I think we have to concentrate as we fight back on chopping down the nonsense. This business of nation of immigrants, the American white population, at the time of the Revolution, had a larger percentage of native-born Americans than any time before or since.
Huh, interesting. This is something you
never
hear.
When the Constitution was written.
Yeah, something you never hear.
Mm-hmm.
But what's interesting is during World War II, during the Nuremberg trials, after World War II, there was a Lieutenant Colonel Murray Bernays, who was the one of the lead prosecutors for the Allies, and he concocted this idea of collective German guilt. And this was used successfully to prosecute the German war criminals. But this idea of collective German guilt has morphed into a collective white guilt. And this seems to be what what our people are being affected by. We're giving away our country and our legacy simply because of this collective white guilt that our children are being taught about in schools at a very young age.
Yeah, the most fanatically anti-white people I know are whites who feel that they're being very moral because they have this idea that when Jesus said, give things away, you know, give to the poor and all that, they feel like if they give away their race, if they hate their own people, that's a great virtue.
Well, yes, I would agree. It's a misinterpretation of the Bible, but we do see this. We see people, you know, basically casting their family aside, casting their race aside, in favor of helping complete strangers.
Well, that's supposed to be a self-sacrificing attitude. I always run on the anti section in Stormfront. I always see these people saying, well, I'm white. How can I be anti-white? Because they have real trouble with my mantra, which is really hard for them to deal with because really this has nothing to do with mixing the races. This is a matter of all white countries and only white countries. This is a matter of straight genocide. And the only thing they can say, because they never run into it, people don't say this, which is why I keep hammering it when I find something that tells the truth and I can just hammer away at it. But they say that, well, I can't be anti-white, I am white. And I just say, it's called treason. It happens all the time.
Yeah, very good. But, right. but you know, it's amazing that white people and just people in general that have any belief of fair play would not see this as being a great injustice. If this were happening to the American Indian or the Japanese people, or any other race of people, you'd hear a huge outcry worldwide. But the fact that it's happening to the white race, it's being ignored and it's being applauded as a great achievement.
Well, this is why I'm preaching to our side. I wanted to get my plug in. I have a blog called, it's in Whitaker Online. It's called Bob's Underground Graduate Seminar. And what we do is we talk about how to make our arguments. In other words, it's sort of practical combat training. And the problem is that it isn't just the conservatives or the liberals or anybody who doesn't notice the point we're making. Nobody notices the point we're making about genocide against whites. Nobody says or notes that nobody, that every white country is supposed to open its borders and, quote, assimilate, unquote. And I just can't find people on our side who will hammer this in. That's genocide. I haven't found anybody who can argue against it. But what I also don't find is people on our side who will push it.
All right, Bob, we'll take a very brief intermission break. My guest is Bob Whitaker, and I'll be right back momentarily. This is Shank Talk Worldwide, and you're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network.
The Voice of Reason Radio.
All right, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Shank Talk Worldwide. I'm your host, Peter Shank. My guest today is Mr. Bob Whitaker. He used to work for the Reagan administration. Bob, what did you do in the Reagan administration when you worked there up on Capitol Hill?
Well, that's sort of like senior staff. It's a little hard to explain. The word senior staff is sort of a coined term on Capitol Hill. It means that, for example, when my congressman went off to China, he made sure I was in the office so I could handle it. It's like your man Steve there, you know, first-rate staff. You just have to turn things over to them. And so my job wasn't all that specific. I would write speeches. I would start I would start initiatives, and I would just do what the congressman would do if he had the time. In the administration, I was in the Office of Personnel Management, and that had to do with security clearances, government hiring, that sort of thing.
What do you think Ronald Reagan's position was on this issue of, what you call white genocide? Did he? Do you think he had a position on this or ever alluded to this problem?
He could never say so. I would think that it bothered him, but he had no opportunity to do anything about it. The president doesn't have all that much power. Despite what people think, what's the remarkable thing about this election is whoever is elected is going to have remarkably little power to do anything. When I was coming up, you had a solid federal budget, and you did have a deficit, but not a crushing deficit. And so you really did have arguments about how much money to spend on what. But today, it was a serious election between two different approaches to, say, government expending on different things or how to deal with the communists. But today, there's really nothing that, there's no initiative that anybody can afford.
Now,
there's really not much power there.
During the Reagan years, there were people like Richard Perle who were, working up on Capitol Hill. Did you ever come across anyone like Richard Perle or Richard Perle himself?
No, huh? Yeah. I try to explain to people, Ronald Reagan was my boss's boss, and the less often you see your boss's boss, the happier you are. And I generally worked on my own. That was true on Capitol Hill, too, because it's just too much for the guy in the chair to handle.
Well,
and so you get, yeah.
What was your experience with the Israeli lobby, groups like AIPAC?
If you just assume they were in power. That's what happened with Fritz Hollings when he got so mad because he had gone liberal and he had tried for the vice presidential nomination and he never even got mentioned. And as a result, he spent all those years, about 30 years, as the junior senator with Strom Thurmond around. But when Strom Thurmond left, Hollings could not run for re-election because he was too liberal. He couldn't have won here. And he was really pissed off because for all his sacrifice for the liberals, he hadn't gotten anything. And so he said what absolutely everybody knew about the absolute control of the Israeli lobby. Do you know about that?
No. Why don't you refresh our memories?
Well, that's all I can say. He just let it not be known that all this Middle East, that our foreign policy was run by the Israeli lobby.
And what year was this?
Let's see, about 2004, I think. It was big news down here, but it, of course they didn't like to repeat it.
Well, back in the 80s, did you see a lot of this going on? Did you see the Israeli lobby? Did you see their influence anywhere in Capitol Hill?
Oh, of course. But that was the sort of thing, it's sort of like racial IQ. It's the sort of thing that everybody knew about and nobody mentioned.
Well, the reason why I ask you about this is because this has been going on for quite a while, and it just seems like every generation of politician or talking head on the media, everyone seems to ignore this, And it goes on and on and on. And you see the Israeli lobby gaining momentum. You see the white race diminishing in power. And there's a correlation there that it seems is being ignored. I believe it needs to be pointed out.
Well, of course it's ignored. I mean, you're ruined if you mention it. That's why I can't go back into politics. I talk about these things. That's why, as I said, what our people do is we talk about Obama's haircut or something like that, and we don't take issues like white genocide and ram it down their throats. We have limited exposure, and we use it on the wrong things. I have what I call Bob's Underground Graduate Seminar. It's called Bugs. It's at www.whitakeronline.org/blog, and it's actually a seminar where we discuss how to repeat these points and where we can get a chance to repeat them and how often we can repeat them before we get driven out of a news group.
You make some interesting points here regarding popular terms that are being used in the media. For instance, you discuss the phrase undocumented worker, and you have a great explanation of why this is a fallacy. It's a phrase that shouldn't be used. Would you explain?
I'm not sure I remember that exact point.
Well, I'll read it to you here very quickly and to refresh your memory. When one uses the phrase undocumented worker instead of illegal alien, the supposition is that citizens are nothing more than documented workers. Would you please elaborate?
Yeah. Well, see, that goes back to your wordism again. It is when you say undocumented worker, you're saying the only difference between someone who was born and raised in Mexico and is loyal to his Hispanics is that they don't have the proper words, they don't have the proper papers. And that is something we work on, that somebody becomes an American just by saying a few words and getting a piece of paper. And so from the point of view of wordism, that's the only difference between a citizen and somebody who sneaks across the border, is that they just don't have some papers that the government has issued. That's what your citizenship depends on.
Now, back in the Reagan administration, they were dealing with the problem of illegal immigration, and they had an amnesty program back in the 80s. This was supposed to cure the problem. This is supposed to put an end to the problem with illegal immigration. And lo and behold, here we are in 2008, and they're trying to pull the same thing again. What was what was your experience on Capitol Hill when this was going on? Can you give us a feel or an idea of the landscape at the time?
Well, we always had that group. That's why when I wrote Societal Property Rights as part of the New Right Papers, which is a pretty important book, I had to write a whole book to get this point in, that a country that economics includes the fact that a country is a good, is richer than another country because the people in it, the country belongs to the people in it who make it productive. The reason that Mexico and places like that, they're unstable. They don't have a decent electorate. They don't have the work ethic. There are a lot of things they don't have, but people always try to break it down into, well, if you write a book and tell them they should have a work ethic, and if you write a book and tell them they should have a stable country, then you should let them in. Because if you give them the right words, they're going to straighten it all out. And that just doesn't work out. Now, what we had was this a great part of the Reagan administration, which of course was a slave to the military, the industrial complex, and the Wall Street Journal wanted cheap labor, and they simply, essentially, said, "Well, it's a good productive environment. Let's bring lots of Mexicans in. Let's bring lots of cheap labor in." So it makes sense from a pure capitalist point of view. If I was an economics professor, and I always noticed they left this out, that you don't just need land, labor, capital, and management to produce things. You also need a country that is made up of people you can trust, of people who can create a society that doesn't have uproar all the time, seizure of property all the time. In other words, the reason that you can invest money in Germany, that you have to pay a higher interest, that you have to accept less interest on a money you spend, you invest in Germany than you do in Mexico, is because that you trust Germans. Germany is Germans, and economics completely. I mean, the classic theory, this classic capitalist theory, just leaves that out. Am I making sense?
Absolutely. Race plays a very important part in the capitalist system and having it work correctly. In addition, religion, I believe, plays an important part. Many religions don't have a concept of fair play or honesty. Many religions in the Middle East, for instance, believe that it's okay to cheat someone who is out of that religion, someone who's not a member of that religion. On the other hand, the Christian religion has usury laws and teaches the idea that it is dishonest and immoral to cheat anyone. And this is why our system in the past, combined with the with the white race being the majority, it seemed to be a good combination and something that was very effective, and it worked. But today, you see the influx of the third world and their various cultural idiosyncrasies, and the whole system is on its head now.
Well, of course, that's a conservative point of view, and I've sort of gotten away from it, because I find that, for example, the Mexicans are very religious. I think my Christianity is about saving the soul, not about saving the economy. So, but a lot of people do like to talk about religion and this sort of thing as being the, because it's a lot safer. I mean, Jerry Falwell can talk about religion being the basis all he wants to, and nobody's going to say anything about it, but he, and that gets him off of the race, and I think that's bad. I think an atheist Germany would be a better place to invest your money than a Catholic Mexico.
Again, as I said just a minute ago, it's a combination of things. It's the moral code that Christianity provides, combined with the white race. For whatever reason, this combination seemed to be very effective at running an orderly, honest society, whereas the Christian religion did not have the same effect in the non-white world. The non-white world didn't embrace Christianity as wholeheartedly, let's say, as the white race did in Europe. But I would not say that the Christian religion as practiced by Mexicans or Africans is the same religion practiced by our ancestors in Europe. It's a completely different animal, in my opinion.
Well, what you're saying is whatever institutions whites have, they're going to have a better version of it. The only reason I'm disagreeing with you is because, first, because it's heresy, which, of course, I always enjoy. But it is that today, too often, people are trying to get away from race and say, well, it's traditional values and this sort of thing. And from what I see, if you simply look at the world, you'll see that if the skin is white, the people live well. If the skin is not white, if the skin is brown, if they're mixed race, they don't live well. They don't invent the sort of thing. So it's called Occam's Law, the simplest explanation. And I think that I have nothing against what you're saying. I just think that too often that's what happened under the Reagan administration. People would say, well, it's really capitalism that makes us rich, you know, or it's really Christianity, so that they could get away from the heretical question, which is, once again, genocide against whites specifically. Nobody's... Anyway, yeah.
No, I follow you, and I don't disagree with you. I'm just merely pointing out a different, another viewpoint, that's all. But the only contradiction with what you're saying that I found in my travels is that of the white people in Eastern Europe. Their experience with with communism has basically eviscerated their culture. They are, their culture is completely destroyed. As a race, you would not even recognize their cultures being white. They've taken on the trappings of black gangbangers. They are now, you know, spray painting their walls, their monuments, their churches. They have no sense of hygiene over there. They don't even have a system to pick up their own garbage. You would not recognize much of Eastern Europe due to the fact that the Soviets completely debased the people there. So that's where I would disagree that genetics alone...
I spent a good deal of time over there, too, in the Eastern, you know, in the East. And I recognize what you say. They had the ultimate word society. And, of course, not just any Christian, any white, but they had the ultimate idea that everything could be run according to the words of Karl Marx. And so I think, but see, that's so unnatural. People notice, oh, by the way, have you noticed that... that a lot of people will say, is Eastern Europe ready for immigration yet? Have you ever heard that?
Yeah, yes, I have, actually.
Well, now, think about that a second, because nobody does. If Vietnam stopped being communist, do you think people would say, is Vietnam ready for immigration yet?
I don't believe that they really would at all. As long as Vietnam remains in the clutches of communism.
No. What I said was, if a non-white country throws off communism, the next question is not, are they ready for immigration yet?
Oh, no, of course not.
We take it so much for granted that a white country must be ready for immigration. All white, they're white countries, they're no longer communist, so are they ready for immigration yet? You see what I mean?
Absolutely, of course.
Yeah, but this is the kind of thing that we don't ram down people's throats. Now, unless you make the argument, you can't get it across. I've made a lot of progress with the genocide argument and with this Eastern European thing. Where I would say, well, why should Eastern Europe, in fact, I was talking to a Bulgarian reporter about this, why is it suddenly that Eastern Europe should be ready for immigration? What does that have to do with it? Well, they're white, right?
Well, that's the thrust of it all, is to integrate all of the white world with non-whites. This is happening in every single white country on the face of the planet.
And the only thing that conservatives, meaning what I call respectable conservatives, object to is not the immigration, but if they don't assimilate. In other words, if they don't marry our daughters, then we resent it. Haven't you heard conservatives come up, well, they don't assimilate.
Exactly. Well, Bob, hold on, because we have more here coming up. Taking a short break. This is Shank Talk Worldwide. I'm your host, Peter Shank. Don't go away, because there is more with my guest, Bob Whitaker. Greetings, ladies and gentlemen. This is Shank Talk Worldwide. I'm your host, Peter Shank, and this is the final segment of my interview with Bob Whitaker. Bob, I'd like to just jump right back in. We've been seeing the in the presidential campaign, the liberals are backing Obama wholeheartedly. And this has been the case since the 1960s, at least, with liberals backing the black candidates or the black civil rights leaders or so on and so forth. You make an interesting point with regards to liberals and their or left-wingers and their support of non-white candidates, non-white civil rights leaders. I'd like you to elaborate and tell us about it.
Well, it goes back to an old joke about the Lone Ranger. And I'm not sure how many people now remember the Lone Ranger, but his faithful Indian companion, Tonto, and there was a joke about the Indians surrounded him and Tonto, and the Lone Ranger turned around to Tonto, and he said, well, it looks like we've had it. Looks like those Indians are going to kill us. And Tonto said, what you mean we, pale face?
Yes, I'm familiar with that joke. That's a gem.
Okay. Well, it has a point to it. I kept saying over and over and over for years in Bugs, which is www.whitakeronline.org/blog, that the faithful colored companions of liberals, they've always, you said that liberals supported them, but actually, in the real world, the Democrats would raise hell about Republicans being so white, but on the other hand, we see them on the streets here, handing black people walking around money, because they know if somebody with a black skin goes to the polling booth, he's going to vote for the liberals, he's going to vote for the Democrats. But the long-term problem is just caused a train wreck with the Clintons, because the Clintons had always counted on their faithful colored companions, but eventually those faithful colored companions, the Hispanics and the blacks, are going to want their own candidates, and there's not going to be any place for white turncoats. And that is a longer-term trend, but I think you can see that the Clintons just ran into it head-on.
I thought it was poetic justice to watch Hillary Clinton squirm under the weight of her own ideology. That was just amazing. The fact that she was... she used to work for the Black Panthers. She's one of the biggest advocates of black power, Hillary Clinton. And because basically she made her bed, and now she has to sleep in it. And it was a wonderful sight, very poetic.
It's just the beginning, because in Congress, for example, the black congressmen are beginning to take over the chairmanships. And the Hispanics are not as wild about Obama as they were supposed to be. See, from a liberal point of view, all colored people are the same. But Obama is not inspiring the Hispanics. They're a little worried about their own bailiwick. So it's not a very stable coalition. But it's always been taken for granted that since Republicans, and I'm not make it a brief for Republicans, let's stop working for them. But the what I'm saying is that all of this traditional values and all this stuff is sort of the past. This thing is becoming more and more racial, more and more openly racial. And a lot of liberals go find themselves without a boat. They get thrown out of the boat run by the minorities. And the question is, are we going to be like the conservatives and let the neoconservatives take us over, all these neo-whites? You know, how are we going to handle this? Because politics is turning racial.
Well, in addition, all you have to do is look at many of our urban centers like Los Angeles and see what the non-whites have done to that city. And they got their positions of power with the help of white liberals, white left-wingers. The minute they took power, they removed all of those white faces and replaced them with black faces and Mexican faces.
Well, this is, I think, as the younger generation comes along, it does get brainwashed. But on the other hand, reality does set in. And what we're dealing with is straight politics. We're going to have to be making, so like the Irish and the Italians made deals in Chicago. I think somebody's going to have to speak for the whites. And the whites will always, for the foreseeable future, be the biggest minority, which could... Actually, I think you're in a better position fighting in a group of minorities as the biggest and baddest, the one with the most people, than you are if you're trying, like whites are now, to sort of rule the whole society and be fair to everybody.
Well, provided that there aren't hate speech laws that would imprison us for just speaking the truth and discussing racial issues.
That's why we have the hate speech laws.
Well, we don't have them here in the States yet, but once we do, we'll be hogtied and severely crippled and hampered with our ability to discuss these racial issues.
Well, we may not have hate laws, but you and me both know what the punishment is for speaking out, whether it's by law or not. We have a lot of that already. But that's what all revolutions run into. You see, the other side is a great deal more aware of this danger. And the hate speech laws and all that, the reason they have them is because they know they're on shaky ground, but we don't exploit that. We don't hit them where they're weak. We keep trying to turn everything into traditional values and every code word we can come up with. Whereas what we have is a racial situation, and I think that's what Bogues is about. We learn to talk in terms of a real racial situation.
Bob, give us a rundown once again. Let us explain what Bogues is.
All right. I did write a book called The Professor Priesthood, where I say, that our established religion in America is political correctness. It's a religion. It's not like a religion. It is a religion. And essentially, the professors are its priesthood. What was the question again?
I wanted you to elaborate on your acronym, BUGS. Let the listeners know what it stands for.
Now, the acronym, it's for Bob's Underground Graduate Seminar, and a seminar, of course, is for graduate students. And I say, since I consider what's called education not to be education, having been a professor, because a lot of people who haven't been exposed to it have a lot clearer minds, and I hope we all know that, I say Bogues is for people who have outgrown their college education, whether they had one or not. And I've got young people on it who have seen through all this stuff. And what Bogues does is a practical business of dealing with, it is against white genocide. It has a little bug up there and it says against white genocide. It's against the genocide of our race. And what we do is we go in and we argue on questions the other side can't answer. We don't try to put things like respectable conservatives do in their terms and say, well, it's crime or it's religion or it's traditional values. No, this is racial. We're here to save our race. We use the, as I say, white countries and only white countries being targeted for immigration assimilation. And we go into that, once again, once you find what the subject is, there's a lot to talk about and how to go about this, what you were bringing up, how to get around the banning of hate sites and that kind of thing.
Now, Bob, you've mentioned your belief in white genocide. Obviously, this is being planned by someone. Someone wants to see this accomplished. Who's behind this?
Well, it's. Yeah, I think you're leading over to the Jews, although the New Englanders were also very much for this intermarriage thing and so forth, you know, at the time, of, right after the Civil War. But, yes, it is. Franz Boas envisioned, and he was one of the leaders, a coalition of anti-white minorities that would unite against whites with with the Jews at their head. And after World War II, the whole Jewish community went along with this.
And would you say that that this is still going on today?
Yeah, but the cancer has metastasized, as they say, and the old fanatical New England anti-whiteism has sort of gone in with it. So it isn't just exposing the Jews alone won't do it, although, and it's sort of interesting that the Jews have their brilliance has ended up, for example, in Europe. They decided to get Hitler back by bringing in the whole Third World. So what they're ending up with is a Muslim population in Europe that feels just a little more hostile to Jews than Joseph Goebbels did. So even from their own point of view, it's stupid.
It is stupid, you know, when you look at it from that point of view. But if you look at it from the Jewish or Zionist point of view, they want to make the rest of the world inhabitable or uninhabitable for Jews, so they'll migrate to Israel. This has been the plan from day one, in my opinion.
Well, I'm sort of... Again, you and I disagree, which thank God we still have the ability to do. I don't believe in plots that are quite that specific because, as Ben Franklin said, three men can keep a secret if two of them are dead. And I think it's what Joseph Sobran called the hive instinct. I think it's about the same thing as a conspiracy. They all get together on this, but you know the Jews we really have trouble with are the ones who are assimilated, who look assimilated. Like the Hasidim have very little interest in us one way or the other. But it's the Judaism is historically hostile to the people around it. Essentially, every Saturday you get a lecture on how Jews are good and everybody else is out to get them. Well, and you can't be raised that way without ending up being hostile to the people around you.
This is true. I when I mentioned to you the idea of making Europe and America uninhabitable for Jews, this is not a conspiracy theory. This is from their own words. This is from the actual world Zionist leaders, people like Theodore Herzl. This was their idea. This is what they've said in their own words. This is not Peter Shank's idea. So when I tell you this, it's based on the public record, not my conspiracy theory. This was their idea and their goal to get the Jews to migrate back to Israel. And the only way they could do it at that time, prior to World War II, was to create this idea that the whole world is against the Jews. This created the kind of paranoia that was necessary to get these Jews to think about migrating to Israel because it was safer there.
Yeah, right. You know, Emma Lazarus, who wrote the inscription on the Statue of Liberty, everybody is always quoting, she was a fanatical Zionist. In other words, her idea was America for everybody, and then there would be one country for Jews. Nobody ever points out that, you know, little contradiction there. But what has happened, of course, is now Israel could not exist alone. They have made the whole world their enemies. The third world hates their guts. The third world, would, not just the Arabs, would be rid of them tomorrow in the UN if they had half a chance. Eastern Europe is very anti-Semitic. Europe is beginning to get a Muslim majority. And so the only thing that keeps Israel alive at this moment is their power in the United States.
Precisely. I've got a question for you that I like to ask my guests. 9-1-1, what did you feel? What was your gut instinct when you saw the CNN videotape or the CNN broadcast on 9-1-1? What did you think was going on?
Well, first, I did have the reaction of being an American that was invasion of our territory. Second, I had the same reaction everybody else. You may remember that there was, for about a month after 9-1-1, what happened was something like 67% said that we needed to reassess our entire relationship with Israel. And that scared them so bad that for a month there was a "It's Not Israel" campaign. Do you remember that?
Absolutely. That set off a lot of red flags in my brain. Yeah. I remember that, yes.
But the percentage dropped down to 57%, and they weren't so worried. But that was everybody's. Two-thirds of Americans said, you know, we've been killing these people in their own homeland, and now they're killing us in ours. And it took the media, which is supposed to control everything, it took them a month. Every single commentator, especially conservatives, who would say this has nothing to do with Israel. Of course, every Arab would mention Israel first.
I remember that. I was very amazed at the news blackout and the constant mantra, "It's not Israel, it's not Israel."
Yeah, that was the mantra. Well, I'll tell you what, it's not Israel. You know how it is when somebody says, "I don't want to steal your wallet." What I don't want to do is steal your wallet. You know?
Yeah, you protest too loudly. Well, Bob, yeah, I'm sure you're familiar with some of the conspiracy theories surrounding 9-1-1. What do you believe happened?
I don't have any strong attachment to it, but I think most things are as they appear. I've been in politics too long, and in hardcore politics and nasty politics, to believe in conspiracies. But there's no particular reason why something should be a conspiracy to be evil.
Well, obviously it was a conspiracy because there were, if you believe the government's official story, there was more than one person that hijacked those planes, so that would dictate or that would lead one to believe that there was indeed a conspiracy.
Yeah, well, it won't do us any good because arguing that doesn't. We've tried it; it doesn't have any effect. So I'm more interested in the actual effect. And also, of course, I had a lot to do with government intelligence. And their inability to do anything is just marvelous. I mean, that they are so. When you put an agency, when you call it top secret, every screw up they have becomes secret. I mean, it's bad enough to have a bureaucracy. So, I go in some detail in Bugs about just how bad the intelligence community is. So,
well, I've always believed. Go ahead.
Yeah.
I was saying that I always have believed that our intelligence agency is very transparent, which is not a good quality for a top secret environment. But
most of them are on the other side anyway. They have this, the CIA is run by a New England group, you know, Harvard University types. And they certainly have no preference for the United States over the Soviet Union, had no preference. And they don't make any bones about it.
Well, Bob, do you have any closing comments?
I just wish people would concentrate on the issue that they can sell, which is that the white race, that there is a, not necessarily conspiracy, but agreement that, as I say, as soon as Eastern Europe got rid of the communists, they wanted to start pouring in the third world. They start talking about, are you ready? That's my big point, because that's the one the other side, in practice, can't handle.
Okay, and how do we reach you on the Internet?
All right, it's www.whitakeronline.org/blog.
Okay, and we can access your website, and you have your books for sale as well.
Yeah, well, they can get the books, and they can have their say too. It's a seminar, not a lecture.
Well, Bob, I want to thank you for your time. It's been a fascinating interview. Fascinating interview, and I want to thank Steve, my producer, for setting this up. He does a fine job.
Don't let him get mad at you. He's too good to lose.
There you go. All right, Bob, thank you very much. Again, I have a lot of respect for you and your service to the country and your service to your race, to our race. So thank you, Bob, and have a great day, and thanks for sharing your time with us.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Shank Talk Worldwide. I'm your host, Peter Shank, and you've been listening to my interview with Bob Whitaker.